after the international news.
Stand up!
Friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA's Sunny Young in Washington. Welcome to the June 10th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. Let's tip off with the National Basketball Association playoffs. The Phoenix Suns trounced the visiting Denver Nuggets by 25 points Wednesday night to take a 2-0 lead in their second-round playoff series. The AP's George Tanner reports from the western U.S. city of Phoenix, Arizona.
The Suns stretched a 10-point halftime lead to as many as 31 in the second half to defeat the Nuggets 123-98 and take a 2-0 lead in their Western Conference semifinal series. Chris Paul had 17 points along with 15 assists and 0 turnovers, the first player to do that in 3 career playoff games.
It's a credit to our coaching staff, to tell you the truth, because the things that we've drilled all season long, it's so nice to see when they come into play in game form, especially in the playoffs.
Nikola Jokic had 24 points, 13 rebounds for the Nuggets.
They're playing better than us. They're aggressive. They're making shots. They're finding open looks. You know, it looks really bad out there. So we need to change everything. We need to be aggressive. We need to hit first.
George Tanner, Phoenix.
Thanks, George. We heard from Nikola Jokic in George's report. The Serbian center won the NBA's Most Valuable Player Award on Tuesday. Meanwhile, French center Rudy Gobert of the Utah Jazz has been named the NBA's Defensive Player of the Year. It's the third time Gobert has earned the honor. The 28-year-old Gobert is in his 8th NBA season. He led the league this season in total defensive rebounds with 720 and in total block shots with 190. Dan Friedell has been chatting with Ben Golliver, the national NBA writer for the Washington Post newspaper. Ben is covering the NBA playoffs, and he also has a new book out, Bubble Ball, a book about life in the NBA bubble last season in Florida. In the second part of their conversation, Ben tells Dan the pandemic caused the NBA to suffer billions of dollars of losses.
Finances. You know, the NBA's stock price, if you want to imagine it as a stock price, was just kind of shooting to the moon, right? I mean, the salary cap growth, the television revenue, all of it was just going up, 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 very dramatically so for the entire 2010s. I mean, this was the most profitable era of expansion the league has really ever seen. And that's why, you know, stars now can sign for $40 million, you know, and possibly pretty soon $50 million for a single season. Whereas back in Michael Jordan's day, that might be pretty close to guys' career earnings, right? And what we saw in 2020 with the shutdown and then the inability to have fans for a lot of this this season after the bubble was billions of dollars in lost revenue, right? So it was a major transition point for the NBA in that sense. But in terms of the competitive landscape, you've had some guys in their mid-20s who are kind of itching to kind of take over control of this league. You've had Giannis knocking on the door, Joel Embiid knocking on the door, Nikola Jokic, you know, knocking on the door. And individually, like, Giannis has won 2 MVPs. Jokic, this year's MVP.
It's something that it's an individual award, but it's effort of everybody who was a part of Denver Nuggets organization. So it's a big thing, but it's not just my word.
But they haven't kind of broken through and gotten over the hump and won the titles. That's been reserved for LeBron James and his super teams, Kevin Durant and Stephen Curry and their super teams, Kawhi Leonard and the teams that he's led here over the past couple of years. And so when you factor in just the natural aging process that goes on with players, you know, plus a really challenging and grueling season this year where they condensed the schedule. They had certain teams had really short off seasons after the bubble, and there's just been injuries and health protocol absences galore all over the league. it does really feel like a changing of the tide, but, you know, we'll see. You know, guys like Kevin Durant, you know, he's been around. He'll have something to still say about this. He's not going to be rushed off stage left. And same with Kawhi Leonard. But I do think we're getting a great look at the NBA's future. You've got the guys who I mentioned earlier, plus Trae Young coming through and having a big breakout. Devin Booker, DeAndre Ayton down in Phoenix having a really nice first-round series. So we're starting to imagine a world without LeBron James maybe, you know, 3, 4, 5 years from now. And that's been something that, you know, the NBA has been synonymous with LeBron really for the entire past decade, if not longer. So, you know, both on and off the court, financially and competitively, the NBA is at a real turning point here.
We're talking with Ben Golliver from the Washington Post, the NBA reporter, mentioning his book, Bubble Ball. We talked about that a little bit. And I did want to take a look at the playoffs this year. LeBron James out in the first round. Do you think that the playoffs are going to miss him? Or do you think, are you excited to see what happens? Here we are, the 8 remaining teams. Are you excited to see some of these players that you just mentioned maybe have a chance to ascend to the top?
Well, it's a fascinating question because I sort of foresee short-term pain and long-term gain, right? The NBA, there's been so much interest in LeBron really for the last 15, almost 20 years that I think he's almost become a crutch in a way, right? I mean, he's made the finals so many times, fans start to pencil them in their minds. Maybe they get disappointed if his team gets eliminated. And the league always puts his teams on the most prominent television showcases, right? It's hard for anybody else to kind of fight for that oxygen because LeBron is such a commanding presence. And you could actually make the argument Kevin Durant, the number two player in the world at that time, felt like he had to go to Golden State to compete with LeBron, not only on the court, but also in terms of, you know, being an off-court icon and you know, a money-generating machine, right? And so there's a big vacuum now that LeBron's not there. And I think that short-term, there could be some pain in terms of the television ratings and fan bases adjusting. And are you as interested if LeBron's not out there? For a lot of casual fans, the answer is they won't be as interested. And same thing with Stephen Curry and the Warriors, who's been a huge television darling for years and who is also not here. But I think longer term, it's better for the NBA that some of these next generation stars who we mentioned earlier get more attention, get more visibility, and get the opportunity to win, because nothing attracts casual fans like championships, right? And you've got a situation where Giannis, Nikola Jokic, Joel Embiid, and even players like James Harden and Paul George are all positioned right now with the opportunity to win their first title. And that kind of validation can be career changing. We saw it for Anthony Davis last year. We've seen it for Kevin Durant when he was in Golden State. And it just elevates you. You know, now you're in the club, right? Barkley and Shaquille O'Neal always talk about, you know, who's in the club, who's not in the club. And I think a lot of fans, you know, view players along that metric. And so I think that this year's title will be really important, because no matter who wins, a major star is going to win a title for the first time. Even if it's Brooklyn, the super team, Harden will get his first ring. And Steve Nash will get his as coach. And even if it's the Clippers, Paul George will finally get to kind of shake some of the reputation that stuck to him these last couple of years, too. So I think it's healthier for the sport that the NBA isn't so dependent upon LeBron. As long as he's here, he's going to be a gigantic story, right? And I live in Los Angeles. I won't be moving away from L.A. anytime soon, as long as LeBron's here. I'll put it that way, right? But it is good to have other people up on that platform with him.
The fact that the Lakers won last year and they got eliminated in the first round, I know they had major injuries, Anthony Davis going out. Do you think that the champion from this year or the champion from last year, as far as adversity and overcoming difficult circumstances, which one do you think is going to kind of be held up as the most valiant effort of the two?
Well, first of all, I want to make it very clear. There should be no asterisk applied to the bubble. And that was a big topic of conversation last summer in terms of like, oh, well, you know, this is different. Oh, it's a Mickey Mouse title. I think some people like to like throw that in LeBron's face. That thing was hard, as I mentioned earlier. And again, it was hard on me, and I was just a writer. I didn't actually have to play and listen to the social media criticism and not be able to be comforted by my family. Like a lot of these players were isolated from their loved ones. And, you know, in some cases, they didn't even bring them to the bubble when they had the opportunity to do so, because logistically it was so challenging. So I would say, first of all, that 2020 title counts like a normal title, and it should be viewed that way by history. Now, this season has been, I've been calling it like, almost like the bite the bullet season, right? The NBA wanted to get through it as quickly as possible in hopes that the following year, you know, the 2021-2022 season would be as normal as possible in terms of fans being in buildings and in terms of revenue generation and in terms of schedule. They just wanted everything to be back to normal, right? And so they had to do whatever they had to this year to get that to happen. And that meant playing games through the pandemic and weathering a lot of positive tests. That meant a lot of players missing times with injuries because they didn't have enough rest time last summer. And that meant shortening the season and changing the kind of the most hallowed thing about the NBA, which is that 82-game schedule, cutting 10 games out of it and altering things that way. So I think to me, this year is actually almost more abnormal than last year. But I think ultimately the winner is going to be validated here because this season, it's really been survival of the fittest. I mean, Anthony Davis was an injury for the Lakers. You had Chris Paul get injured for the Suns. Joel Embiid got injured for the Sixers. James Harden got injured for the Brooklyn Nets. Jamal Murray got injured for the Denver Nuggets. And those are only the star-level players. I mean, there's other major injuries factoring here. So I think people will probably look back on this year's champion, especially if it isn't Brooklyn, because they're the most talented team right now. And they will say, well, look, you know, that was a little bit of a different year, and injuries played a huge role. We should always remember it. But I think that because it's a survival of the fittest, you've got to be tough mentally. You've got to be good offensively and defensively. And there's enough good teams left in this year's postseason for them to be able to check all those boxes. You know, Utah, they're new. We haven't seen them on this kind of a prominent stage in years past, but they're really good. Phoenix has been surprising people all season long. And the list goes on from there in terms of teams who are title worthy. So I view this year differently. Obviously, the bubble is always going to be viewed differently, but I would say, you know, grant these champions all of their credit. Don't try to take anything away from them.
Thanks, Ben. It really has been a pleasure reading your book. It's called Bubble Ball. I recommend it to anybody who can get their hands on it. And reading your work in the Washington Post. Ben, thanks so much for joining us on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for the conversation.
This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, I'm Helen Maroulis, Olympic champion for Team USA, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
And I know Helen Maroulis is looking forward to defending her Olympic gold medal in women's wrestling in Tokyo. And mark your calendars, Olympic fans! We're now 43 days away from the opening ceremony in Japan's capital. Well, the U.S. men's national soccer team has been playing well as it incorporates some talented younger players. The USA beat Costa Rica Wednesday night 4-0 in a friendly international match played in the western U.S. city of Sandy, Utah. The Americans got their goals from four different players: Gio Reyna, the son of former U.S. soccer star Claudio Reyna. And the three other goals came from Brendan Aronson, Daryl Dike, and Reggie Cannon. It was the first international goals for Cannon and Dike, who was born in Oklahoma, but whose parents are from Nigeria. In fact, Daryl Dike's oldest brother, Bright, and his sister, Courtney, have both played for Nigeria's men's and women's national football teams. The victory over Costa Rica came 3 days after the USA beat regional rival Mexico 3-2 in extra time to win the first CONCACAF Nations League trophy. And with the win, the U.S. men's national soccer team improved its record to 11 wins, one loss, and one draw in its past 13 matches.
Sporty greetings. This is Sunday Oliseh, former captain and coach of the Super Eagles of Nigeria. You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. Thanks.
Thanks, Sunday. Sunday Oliseh's beloved Super Eagles of Nigeria have been less than super in their past two matches. They played friendly internationals against neighbor Cameroon in Austria. Cameroon beat Nigeria 1-0, and then the teams played a scoreless draw. For reaction, Iron Mike Mbonye spoke with the chief football writer at ACLSports.com in Nigeria, Fisayo Dairo.
Well, I must say that for the neutrals, they have two very good games. I must admit that I was impressed by the quality exhibited by both players because it's not been easy for them. They have just concluded a very rigorous season in Europe. The players did not have adequate summer breaks last year due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So having to play a couple of friendly games for national teams immediately after the end of a very thorough and long season, I was impressed with what they put. But if you ask me from a Nigerian perspective, I think I reserve the right to be disappointed in what the Super Eagles did in both games. Playing 180 minutes against Cameroon without scoring a single goal, you have to be disappointed. This is the same team that have been having difficulties to get one over us in the past few years, and now we are lending them a hand in starting another form of dominance against us ahead of the Nations Cup, which they will be hosting next January. I think on Friday night, we started late in terms of coming into the game, created a number of chances that Nigeria, but they couldn't take the chances and they allowed Cameroon to run away with the win. But on Tuesday evening, the performance was not good at all until in the last 15 minutes of thereabout when the Cameroonians were obviously tiring out. So I think it wasn't pleasing for any Super Eagles fan because once again, the dire form in international friendlies continue for the Super Eagles. Nigeria have not won any international friendly game since March 2019. It's becoming a long time now. You don't speak well for the attitude of the players in competitions and in games like this. I do hope that it will not affect when they regroup in August ahead of the World Cup qualifying series.
Any outstanding player on the Nigerian side, and what's your take on the players that made their debut for the Super Eagles?
I do not think there are many outstanding players in the Nigerian side, and I think the results quite clearly point towards that. A goalless draw on Tuesday, losing 1-0 on Friday night shows you that perhaps some of the players did not live up to the expectations. Having said that, I think Chidozie Awuzie, who plays for the Portuguese club Boavista, did very well at centre-back, played 90 minutes in both matches. He's been with the team since 2016, but hasn't really been able to nail his starting shirt down. He was at the World Cup or the Nations Cup, but couldn't really play much. So having a chance to play in a friendly game like this, I think he covered himself in glory, especially on Tuesday when he partnered with a so-called green on, that's Valentin Ozoma, who was starting his first game for the Super Eagles. I should also give a wordy mention to Alex Iwobi, who I think did well in propelling the team. He played as a right midfielder on Friday night, and on Tuesday he played as a central attacking midfielder. I think he moved the ball well, and he deserves some credit. So also Wilfred Ndidi, who we all know what he can do. He's one of the best defensive midfielders in the world. His steady presence at defensive midfield also aided the team well. For the debutants, I mentioned Ozoma for earlier on, made his debut on Friday night as a substitute, and on Tuesday he played 90 minutes, and I think he was composed. I think he wasn't really ruffled, and with the help of Awuzie in some cases, he really had a good game, a good full debut. And for Abraham Marcos, he came on as a substitute for both games. Marcos plays for a second division club in Portugal, Farense, a nimble-footed winger, left-footed. He really showed promises, a young talent, and he showed that he is destined to go places if he can keep his head down. And finally, we have Terry Murphy, who was a revelation in the French Ligue 1 with Lorient. And this time around, he came on at halftime again for Paul Onuachu on Tuesday. And although he didn't have much to do, but I must give him credit. But if he's going to play for the Super Eagles in a position so blessed with lots of attacking talent, he really has to do more than he did on Tuesday.
What should be done to put the Super Eagles in good shape ahead of the World Cup qualifiers scheduled to start in September?
We have just seen two friendly matches. That means the Federation have done their bit for the team in giving them adequate preparatory games ahead of the matches. So by the time they regroup in August, everything is left to the head coach, Gernot Rohr, and his players. I particularly was not happy that Rohr did not particularly make good use of this window, because there were a number of players that did not taste a minute of action in those two friendly games. Players like Anthony Zuchuku, Samson Tijani, two goalkeepers actually, Francis Uzom and John Nobu, Vincent Onovo. This player did not taste a minute of action in the two friendly games. I don't think it's good enough. But by and large, everything now rests totally on the shoulders of Gernot Rohr to bring his A game into the party by the time Nigeria faced Liberia in their first game in late August before taking on Cape Verde Island. So everything is left to him. He has to ensure that he keeps his record of qualifying Nigeria for major tournaments with a game to spare by the time we start the hostilities for the World Cup qualifiers. I do believe that by the time the top stars return, talking about players like Leon Balogun, Zaidu Sanusi from FC Porto, players like Joe Aribo, also a Balogun's teammate as Glasgow Rangers, players like Victor Osimhen of Napoli, Samuel Chukwueze of Villarreal, I do hope that the players will get the needed steam and steel that is required to really qualify Nigeria for the Mundial.
That's Fasayo Dairo, the chief football writer at ACLSports.com in Nigeria. And he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Port Harcourt, Nigeria.
Sporting greetings. This is William Chosekong from Watford Football Club and Nigeria Super Eagles. You're listening to the Sunny Sides of Sports on the Voice of America.
Hi, this is Rick Pantaleo. Coming up on the Science Edition of Press Conference USA, experts from Johns Hopkins Medicine will give us an update on the COVID-19 pandemic, talk about its impact on our mental health, and how we can prepare ourselves to resume our lives in a post-pandemic world. That's the Science Edition of Press Conference USA. Listen for it this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossings, where we feature music and interviews along with your favorite artists from around the world. Tune in and interact live with us here in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Shirin.
Hello, Larry. How are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT.
Thanks, Larry. That's Larry London, a man who's always ready to cross musical borders. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America. In African boxing, undefeated Nigerian heavyweight Efe Ajagba looks like he'll have a very good test next month in Las Vegas, Nevada. Reports say Ajagba has agreed to fight another undefeated fighter, the Cuban Frank Sanchez, on the undercard of the Tyson Fury-Deontay Wilder main event on July 24th. Ajagba has won all 15 of his professional fights with 12 knockouts. Sanchez has won all 18 of his bouts with 13 knockouts. Ajagba is coming off an impressive knockout victory, as we hear now from our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta.
Sonny, homeboy, Efe Ajagba, man. Woo-hoo. That was a devastating knockout. It's a one-punch knockout. Lights out, Sonny, against American Brian Howard, you know. This is his second fight with his new coach, Coach Koroma. Efe Ajagba is 15-0 with 12 knockouts. He's ranked number 9 in the prestigious World Boxing Council, number 13 with the World Boxing Association. Homeboy is about to strike, because right now, once you take out the elite of your Anthony Joshua, Deontay Wilder, Tyson Fury, the next class is your Efe Ajagba, Joe Joyce, and all these other folks. But among that class, Efe Ajagba stands out. I mean, 15-0 with 12 knockouts. And mind you, these knockouts have been on television, you know, so millions of fight fans, they follow him. So Kudos to F.A. Jagba.
Thanks, Namdi. That's Namdi Hollywood Moeta, our reigning prince of pugilistics. Turning to tennis, the defending French Open women's singles champion from Poland has been eliminated in the quarterfinals in Paris. Joining us with more details is VOA's Gwen Uden. Sporty greetings, Gwen.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. The last woman to retain the French Open title was Belgian Justine Henin in 2007. And on Wednesday, Iga Swiatek's title defense came to an end after she lost to Greek Maria Sakkari in straight sets. Afterwards, Swiatek admitted she was simply overwhelmed by her opponent.
Well, obviously, I didn't play my best tennis, that's for sure. But Maria did a good job with, you know, playing out my forehand, which wasn't working pretty well today. So it's, you know, good for her that she saw that and she picked the good tactics for sure. You know, I struggled with picking the right place where to play, and I couldn't play some shots that usually give me points.
Swiatek still has a chance to claim a French Open title. She has advanced to the semifinals in doubles alongside American partner Bethany Mattek-Sands. Their match will be played on Friday. Meanwhile, immediately following her quarterfinal win, Maria Sakkari said her run at the French Open is a dream come true.
A dream coming true, you know how it feels, better than anyone in here. So, I don't know, it's a very nice feeling, and, you know, I could have done it without, you know, my team and their support, and I just want to thank them, and we still have a long way to go, of course, but, you know, we made a huge step today.
17th seed Sakkari will face Czech Barbora Krejcikova as the highest-ranked player in the tournament and the first Greek woman to reach a Grand Slam semifinal. She's the second Greek in the semifinals at this year's French Open. The first is compatriot Stefanos Tsitsipas, who advanced to the men's Final Four on Tuesday. Barbora Krejcikova advanced to the semifinals after her straight-set win over American Coco Gauff. Krejcikova is also in the Final Four in women's doubles with Czech partner Kateřina Siniaková. They will open the women's doubles semifinal round on Friday. On the men's side, defending champion Rafael Nadal dropped a set in Paris for the first time in 2 years, but he was able to fight back and defeat Argentine Diego Schwartzman in four sets. After the match, a reporter pointed out that Nadal has won 105 of his 107 matches at Roland Garros, but the 13-time French Open champion said he'll reflect on his extraordinary achievements at the end of his career.
The numbers are just amazing, no? But I can't think about that now, no? Honestly, no. Let's talk about that when I finish my career. Now is a moment to be happy. And yeah, it's a moment to enjoy today and to try to start preparing for that semi-final.
And Nadal is one half of what is sure to be an electrifying semifinal showdown against his opponent, world number one Novak Djokovic, who advanced after clinching a four-set victory against Italian Matteo Berrettini. Djokovic is vying for a second French Open title and told reporters he's looking forward to his match against Rafael Nadal, who he describes as his biggest on-court rival.
It's not like any other match. I mean, let's face it's you know, it's the biggest challenge that you can have, playing on clay against Nadal in this court in which he has had so much success in his career, and in the final stages of the Grand Slam. It doesn't get bigger than that. So yeah, I would probably pick Rafa as the biggest rival I've ever had in my career, and the anticipation for the match against him, any match or any surface on any occasion, is always different from any other.
Djokovic and Nadal will meet for the 58th time in their semifinal match on Friday. The excitement is building. More tennis news to come. Sonny, I'll hand it back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uden. that wraps up the June 10th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington, and that's the sunny side of sports.